right now.
This is
2FM's Game On.
Hello there and good evening. Firstly, big thanks to Demi and Mikey for driving us into the weekend. It is Friday, October 17th. I'm Shane Dawson and you are listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the official chart show at 7, it's a big night in the League of Ireland and the Premier League returns after the international break. Alan Colley and Fergal Brennan are standing by to go through all the big talking points while Damien O'Mara delves in from Richmond Park. Jade Mangan previews Champions Day at Ascot. Brian Keogh has the latest golf news with Shane Lowry, one off the lead in India. And Mark Landers tells us what is so special about the Cork Hurling Championship and why it's referred to as the Little All-Ireland. You can get in touch by texting 51552, WhatsApp us on 087-187-9200 or find us on X at GameOn2FM.
This is
2FM's
Game On.
This is Game on 2FM indeed. This is Shane Dawson alongside Alan Colley. Happy Friday, Alan. How are you?
Shane, it's always a happy Friday when I'm sitting here with you, standing here with you.
And some whatever. League of Ireland to look forward to.
Absolutely, and a full round of fixtures as well, which has been rare enough over the last few weeks. But
the last full Friday night.
Is it?
The last full Friday night. So we Friday, October 24th, you've Galway, Drogheda, Pats, Waterford, Sligo, Cork, but it's the last full round. Last round that is on a Saturday, next Saturday afternoon. We've a couple of midweek fixtures, Bows and Pats on Monday, so full round on Friday.
There you go.
It's flown by, hasn't it, this season?
It has flown by, yeah. Has it lived up to expectation, Shane? That's the question. There's one for you.
That's a very good question.
3 minutes into the show.
I asked the questions here. you should know how this works on a Friday by now. Has it lived up to expectation? Well, there's going to be a proper European race. There's going to
be a good race.
A race for the playoff. I know we've relegation confirmed with Cork City. Shamrock Rovers just need a point against St. Pat's and Inchicore. Even if they fail to get at least a draw, Derry City must win in Waterford to prolong the race for another week. Rovers defeated 10 men Shelburne last Friday, prolonged their way to be crowned champions. Well, Monday's victory for Shells and Turner's Cross, as I alluded to, Cork City, the only side with nothing to play for tonight after being officially relegated. Are we going to finally see the League of Ireland champions crowned?
I think that's always a good sign of a decent season, Shane, when we're kind of a couple of weeks out from the end and there's still loads to play for. And yeah, as much as it looks like, well, it is inevitable as to when Shamrock Rovers will win it, they still have to get the job done. And that's obviously tonight. And I think they will, Shane. I have to be honest. I'm very disappointed with St. Pat's at the moment. We were obviously, now I know they played a Leinster Senior Cup game last week, but their last main game, if you like, was... Well, they'll still count that
massive
as a game.
Credit to you for shoehorning in the Leinster Senior Cup.
Well, they did play a game, to be fair.
Yeah. Moctis, was it?
It was Moctis, yeah. But I didn't. But in terms of, I suppose, the reaction of what we'll see coming off the back of the cup defeat tonight will be very telling in terms of that reaction. And obviously Stephen Kenny would have been reiterating the message to them that they're still very much in the hunt for that European place. But when you look at the Dublin Derby record, who do you think out of the four clubs is on top of the mini table?
Bows.
I'm hitting you with some big ones tonight, Shane. Bohemians are. You've obviously seen this table.
No, I just off the top of my head, Alan. This is why I'm in the presenter's chair here. I'd say Shells are second.
Yeah.
And then I would say Rovers are third.
Yes, and it's very tight between those three. So when you look at Bohemians, played 10, 17 points, Shane. Shelburne have played 10, 16 points. Shamrock Rovers have played a game extra on 15 points. And then the gap to St. Patrick's Athletic, who've been absolutely horrendous in the Dublin derbies, 6 points.
Wow.
And that's a big jump.
That's a massive jump. So is this going to be an old Dublin Derby scrap then this evening? Pats won't want Rovers lifting the trophy like they did in 2023.
This is the issue I have with St. Patrick's Athletic. If it becomes a scrap, they lose. And I just think they're soft-centred. There's something lacking in them. There's something missing. We saw that when it became, I suppose, the challenge was put up to them in a pack Turner's Cross in the semi-final. They started like a house on fire, Cork City. And there was no reaction from St. Patrick's Athletic. Huge crowd down, over 1,000 fans, well-supported. And the players just didn't deliver, basically. And they've been so inconsistent all season. And when you look at that record, now they've played a game less than those teams, but still 6 points, Shane. They've only one win in the Dublin Derbies, so that would give you no confidence that they could get the job done against Shamrock Rovers tonight.
Three Dublin Derbies in the running,
so but I've ruled them out of the race, to be honest with you. Anyway, I don't think they're They're obviously in the race, but I don't think
mathematically, yeah, but realistically.
But I don't think they're going to be the team that's going to finish in those European places.
Pico Lopez will return from international duty after helping Cape Verde qualify for the World Cup for the first time next summer when Lopez plays at the World Cup. It will mark his 10-year anniversary from playing part-time football and working in EBS to playing on the biggest stage of all. And as David Snaid pointed out on Twitter, fittingly, someone who grew up a few minutes away from the Walk and Sound roundabout will give people reason to celebrate there again at the next World Cup. What a story for Pico. And I really hope he plays this evening.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. He'll get some reception, and he should get a reception off all the supporters, really, because it's some achievement. And the backstory, as you say, Shane, I remember when he made the move to Shamrock Rovers, which was a big move in itself, going from Bohemians to Shamrock Rovers, because he was well liked in Dalymount, but very raw, technically wasn't the best, but a brilliant attitude, brilliant lad, and he's made himself into a very, very good defender, one of the best that we've probably seen in the League of Ireland. And technically his game has improved massively when obviously you're surrounded by brilliant players in Shamrock Rovers and the coaching that he's getting there. So for him to achieve all that he's done so far domestically, and then to top it off with featuring at a World Cup next year, it's a phenomenal story, and good luck to him, because I don't know him all that well, but by all accounts a great lad as well.
Well, Owen Doyle has a great article on the RT Sport website. Who knows him quite well from his playing days, and was giving out that referees loved him, never got at him, but he does have a brilliant line of, he is unapologetically authentic, he's not betraying one country by representing another, he's enriching both. So best of luck to Pico Lopez. If Shamrock Rovers are going to be crowned champions this evening, we'll dial into Damon O'Mara very shortly. He's at Richmond Park. We'll be chatting to him later. Another stalwart of the League of Ireland, Pádraig Amant, top goal scorer, and Waterford certainly will be hoping the league's top scorer can produce the goods again. Great story actually, Amant, this week. 3 hard years of juggling, being a husband, a dad, football, moving countries and university, but he graduated with a sports fitness and coaching degree this week. Waterford take on Derry on the back of victories 2 weeks ago, still with work to do to avoid the relegation playoff. Derry looking to cement second place, Shells chasing them. How do you see this one playing out, the RSC?
Yeah. Well, they'll obviously gain huge confidence from the victory there a couple of weeks ago against Drogheda, so they'll take that into the game, Shane.
New manager boost as well?
Yeah, well, that's exactly, because I had them doomed before that, but because of, I suppose, the poor run of form with John Coleman, I think that they took the right course of action to remove him, and the lad that's come in was there earlier on in the season
Matt
as well.
Lawler, yeah.
And I'm surprised they never went for him off the back of the good job that he did earlier in the season. Yes, a small sample size, I think it was only the 3 or 4 games, but did very well. So he's back in, and to start off his reign again with a victory against Drogheda, who were pushing for Europe themselves, was a great result. At home again, I think that's a big advantage for them as well, Shane. Derry, to be fair, have been quite good over the course of the season, a little bit too inconsistent to put up a sustained title challenge, but in terms of Tiernan Lynch's first year in the job, I think that'll be acceptable enough if they finish second and get into Europe and build from there. But they'll certainly want to see, with the resources he has at his disposal, they'll certainly want to see a more sustained title challenge, if you like, next year. But I think Waterford will get something out of this game tonight. I really do. I think they've a little bit of momentum behind them off the back of that little bounce, as you say, and a victory against Drogheda. So I'm going to go for a draw.
Oh, a draw. Okay, 2 more wins would be enough for Derry to stay inside the top 4.
I'm giving them a place.
Top 4 gets Europe if Shamrock Rovers were to win the Cup. Jack Henry Francis will come up against his former side, Sligo Rovers. I know you're off to Tolka Park later. Shelburne have found their groove at the perfect time after defeat to Drogheda last month. They were outsiders for Europe, but 6 points on the road in the last week has certainly changed that. This good run of form for Shelburne can't go on, can it, Alan Colley?
I hate to say it, that it can, Shane. Absolutely it can. And that's why I'm a little bit worried from a Sligo Rovers point of view, because they have hit a rich vein of form just at the right time of the season. And obviously to beat Shamrock Rovers, then you go to Cork on Monday night. Difficult place to go at any time of the season, but especially off the back of them beating St. Pat's and fighting for their lives. I think that was a big victory for Shelburne as well. And that has put them in the prime position now to get that European place. So I'd be a little bit worried for Sligo Rovers tonight. I think Shelburne are in very good form. And as you say, the addition of Jack Henry Francis as well, absolutely fantastic signing, scored during the week, also got the winner against Cork. Sligo Rovers will be disappointed with the fact that they lost so late on against Derry the last day out, Duffy scoring with a late goal in injury time. But before that, their form was very good, bouncing back off the Curry kind of disappointment, really, is the best probably way of describing it. Yeah, 7 points out of 9 they got in the next 3 games, and that's effectively got them into a strong position to stay up. And that allowed, I suppose, the fact that they did lose the the concession of that late goal against Derry City. They're still in a decent enough position when you look at the league table, but I think they have to try and get something from Talca Park tonight, but that's a difficult ask in my view, and I think that will be a tough challenge for them. They're sitting on 37 points, same number as Waterford. I've already said Waterford might get a draw, and then Galway, who are 3 points behind them, a game in hand, they're playing Bohemians tonight, but I think Bohemians will beat them. I saw Bohemians Saturday, and I know it was only a friendly, but they were brilliant in the first half, Shane. And the game, to be fair, wasn't played like a friendly. The first half against Schalke, they played a kind of end of season friendly against them, if you like, but there was a real intensity to it. If they bring that form into the game against Galway tonight, I think they'll beat Galway.
Galway need at least one win to avoid the playoff with four matches remaining. Now that's of course easier said than done, given they only have one victory in the last 12, and that was against Cork. So a massive turnaround is needed for John Caulfield's side. We spoke about Patson, their lack of mental strength, perhaps it's fair to say. Can Galway grind it out?
Yeah,
John Caulfield traditionally can, surely.
I was actually speaking to someone at the game in Dalymount, funny enough, and Cian Byrne's name came up because he was obviously playing against, or sorry, he was playing for Bohemians, and he came back to Bowes in the second part of the season and has kind of established himself in the team there. I think he's a very good young player, Cian, and everybody points to the fact, myself included, that when Galway lost Moses Dyer
and Cian Byrne,
and we read out the stats here one night, and to be fair, they're obvious stats because he was the goal scorer. He was up, he's still up amongst the top goal scorers. I think he finished on 10, Moses Dyer, and I think the leader at the moment is on 13. So it just goes to show the impact he was having with Galway. But a great point was made to me, that was when they lost Cian Byrne as well. Because he was, and I was, funny enough, I was at a game earlier on in the season, Sligo Rovers against Galway, when Cian Byrne scored a free kick. I think he scored in general play as well when they beat Sligo Rovers. But he's been a big miss also for them, Shane. And to be fair to Galway, they're still fighting. We obviously did the game in the cup match against St. Pat's, the quarter final. And the only thing they're missing is that just little bit of quality. Brilliant, honest professionals, good lads, trying their heart out, as you'd expect from a John Caulfield team. They're just lacking a little bit of quality at the top end of the pitch.
Okay, and you would imagine then Drogheda United out of the European position, it's a must win against Cork City. Cork City already relegated, so hopefully for Kev Doherty and Drogheda, say Cork might be having that eye on the cup final.
I think it's a good night for them to play Cork, because Jernash has to start thinking about that, and especially the likes of Shawnee Maguire, Wrapham and Cotton Wool now for a couple of weeks.
Okay, great stuff. Let's chat Premier League. Fergal Brennan is on the line as well. Alan Colley, you're sticking around to continue this football conversation. Ruben Amorim has been given a vote of confidence by Ratcliffe. Is this the kiss of death, or is this a genuine vote of confidence, Fergal Brennan?
It's a difficult one to gauge, because you know we exist in a world where we normally hear the standard statement of manager's got the full support, and then a few weeks later they could be sacked. I think Jim Ratcliffe has put himself in a position where he likes doing interviews, he likes getting his sound bites out there and making headlines with what he has to say about Manchester United. I just don't think he believes it. I don't think many Manchester United fans believe it. I think if he just offered his immediate support to Amorim and his difficult situation, etc., etc., that'd be something that the fans could buy into, because they could say he's not trying to feed us with false positivity. I don't think anybody looks at Amorim's situation and sees him at Manchester United in 3 years' time. I think that's actually kind of unfair on him to put that type of a time frame. They've had a little bit of an uptick in form. Obviously, they got that win just before the international break. Huge game this weekend against Liverpool that they're going to as clear second favourites, despite Liverpool having a bit of a dip themselves. So, I don't think it helps Ruben Amorim, because he's not stupid. He knows the situation that he finds himself in as well. He's under big pressure. And if come the next international break, United have, I don't know, for example, maybe just picked up one more win, that could be the end of him.
Did the international break come at perhaps the right time for Liverpool? They were a bit shaky going into it, Alan. And also, can Manchester United trouble Liverpool this weekend? Truly trouble them now? Or are we just going to see the same old inconsistent Man
well,
United?
Just on the Jim Ratcliffe stuff there, is that his second or third vote of confidence already? Have I not heard this before?
It's all these false dawns. It's like they have a big... They'll win on Sunday, Manchester United. It's like, this is the turning point. This is when it all kicks off.
I have heard a couple of backings, all right, but... I just can't see it getting any better, I have to be honest with you, Shane. And you look at how inconsistent they are. Their last five games, win one, lose one, win one, lose one. And they obviously got the victory against Sunderland. Can they trouble Liverpool? Yes, they can, because Liverpool have been troubled by every team that we've seen so far this season. So I suppose the question you posed about, did the break come at the right time? I think it did. But I think Arnie Slot has a lot of issues to solve there in terms of the defensive issues, if you like. You move it into midfield, trying to fit players in when he had this steady three last year of Gravenberch, Szoboszlai and McAllister. Obviously, Wirtz has come into the picture now, so you're trying to fit him in. You're trying to get Szoboszlai into the team, and he's dropped him into right full a good few times. So obviously, you're leaving out the likes of Bradley or Frimpong, whoever the case may be. Then you have Kerkez in and out with Robertson, hasn't kind of hit the ground running. I think he's been better in the last couple of games, Kerkez. Saw Robertson over the international window with Scotland. He was at fault for the goal for Belarus. Thought he was poor enough. Then you get to the top end of the pitch, Shane, and obviously Isak hasn't hit the ground running. Ekitike has been the bright spark. He's been very, very good. But you feel as though if Isak is around, Ekitike might not play. Salah hasn't been in good form. So there's probably five or six things I'm after pointing out there about the team that, when you think we used to speak about Slot last year and it was a seamless transition and there was none of these concerns, none of these worries, they were just going out reeling off the wins, playing very well, very impressive in everything that they were doing. Whereas now, for the first time, he has to manage, he has to do his job. And it's a big job, as I say. There's a lot of things to fix there. And I don't think he would have got them fixed over the course of a couple of weeks, especially when a lot of those players were away on international duty themselves. I watched Wirtz. You think maybe in amongst his old kind of teammates Germany playing for Northern Ireland, didn't get a kick. It was like watching the Wirtz that we're seeing with Liverpool. Now, he's a brilliant player, Shane. That's not me saying I think he's a brilliant player. He's just going through a rough little spell at the moment, adjusting to Premier League life, and he's just low on confidence. So I think there's a lot for Slot to sort out. Obviously, I think he will get it sorted out in time. Whereas with Man United and Ruben Amorim, I don't care how long he's there, he's not getting it fixed.
You've made that point of view. As much as Ratcliffe has given him the vote of confidence, you've called him out, to be fair. You're consistent of nothing else, Alan Colley. With all that in mind, from Liverpool point of view, Fergal Brennan, how important is it for Arsenal to really just put the foot down? I know they've Champions League on Tuesday to contend with. They've Martin Odegaard out now for 6 weeks with a knee injury. Declan Rice, Bukayo Saka were playing back-to-back matches for England. But to be able to win on Saturday and to have a four-point lead before Liverpool kick a ball must mentally be big.
Absolutely. And looking ahead to some of the fixtures that they've got between now and the next international break, Fulham away this weekend, then Atletico Madrid in the Champions League, Palace, Brighton at home in the Carabao Cup, and then a little bit further ahead, Burnley away and Sunderland away before that November break. They need as close to maximum points as they can get, as much in terms of putting up a gap between themselves and Liverpool as creating that kind of mental stability. That is going to be the question for Arsenal this season. Not the players that they've got, not the strength in depth. It's that mental fragility. And it is going to be a question that's thrown at them week after week after week by ourselves chatting, by their own fans, by everybody, because that's the real question mark that still exists over them. They've got an incredibly talented team. They've got lots of players split across all sorts of positions. They've got 2-3 players for most key spots in the starting 11. The big thing for them is going to be, can you do it when the pressure ramps up, when you've got players who've not been in a position of winning a title before, but do have a position of falling away, and not just once, twice and three times for a lot of them. And obviously May seems like a long way away at the moment, but it starts now. They have to take advantage of when Liverpool are having a bit of a wobble. As you say, they've got to put the foot down and say, we're going to go and win this game and win again and win again and win again, and force Liverpool into a position where they're chasing them.
Staying on the topic of managers under pressure, Alan Colley, Ange Postecoglou and Nottingham Forest. So he's failed to secure a win in his 7 games in charge. Now, there are reports suggesting that Sean Dyche is waiting to take over. 12:30 tomorrow, Forest against Chelsea. Are we already at a stage of win or bust for Ange?
Absolutely, yeah. Because all the talk, Shane, now, whether that's right or wrong, you can debate it as long as you want. But certainly in terms of all the noises that we're hearing coming out of Nottingham Forest, from the owner included, he has to win tomorrow. I think if he loses, he's gone. And I don't think they will win. I think it was a wrong appointment for the group of players and for the job that Nuno had done. Now, that's not Ange Postecoglou's fault in terms of Nuno having a falling out with the owner or whatever, and it was always inevitable that he was going to go then. And whatever's gone on behind the scenes, we're not privy to that. But once Nuno came out publicly criticising that owner, he was gone, he was done. Now, I'm completely against the owner and how he behaved towards Nuno at the back end of the season and coming on the pitch and all. And Nuno's done a brilliant job for him. So I think Nuno has left in a position of strength, and now he's walked into a new job. So his stock is still kind of looked after, if you like. Then to bring in Postecoglou, a manager who we have criticised time and time again on the show all throughout last year, just for the way he sets up his approach. He's already disgruntled, it looks like, the players. The fans want him out, which I think is wrong. The fans singing you're getting sacked in the morning, like, it's a bit disrespectful, to be fair, but it just goes to show they didn't want him. So it's a bit of a messy situation, Shane, and I can only see it ending one way, and that's obviously if they lose tomorrow and he'll be gone. I don't think Postecoglou was good enough, to be honest, for the Premier League. I think just with what he did last year, it was just... It was staggering, really, in terms of how poorly they were coached and set up in a lot of those games, especially, and he had a good group of players, and despite the fact that he'll argue he had a lot of injuries, he can still set the team up pretty well if you have a few injuries. He's gone into Forest, a team that had an unbelievable defensive record under Nuno, and they're conceding goals left, right and centre. So do the maths.
Yeah, can't buy a goal either at the other end of the pitch. Fergal, final one on our Premier League chat. 13 months after suffering a near season-ending knee injury against Arsenal, Rodri's medical problems remain a concern for the player and indeed for Pep Guardiola. How important is he still to how successful this Manchester City team can be?
Massive. We saw that last season. He wasn't the only reason for why they kind of dropped from their incredible standards of winning trophies and dominating the Premier League, but he was huge. I don't think anybody underrates him, despite the position that he plays being famous for kind of almost being missed, or the type of player that you miss when he's not in the team. I think everyone was well aware of how important he was, and he remains that, because if you look at the changes that City have made over the summer, they brought in Reinders to play alongside him. Well, he likes to get forward. He's got a goal in him. He's very, very athletic. Rodri's brief was to come back into the team, build himself obviously back up to full fitness, but just control that area of the pitch. If City lose possession and they get broken on, he is there to deal with it. He's there to just keep them ticking over, maybe with a bit less charging around than he did previously, but still massively, massively important. The experience, the in-game knowledge that he's got is huge. And City themselves are, I wouldn't quite say in a rebuilding phase, but in a semi-rebuild. They brought in quite a few new players. They've obviously lost some big leaders in Walker and De Bruyne that have moved on. So he's massively important. And it is frustrating. He's such an important player for them. He's a fantastic player to watch for neutrals who are following Manchester City and the Spanish national side as well. Don't forget, he's been missing bits and pieces for them as well. He was injured in the final of Euro 2024 when they beat England. So he will be a miss for club and country. Guardiola now, with Reinders in there, has got more bodies that he can reshape and kind of plan without him. But he's hugely important just for offering that level of control that allows Silva, Reinders, Foden, who's back in a bit of form, just to go forward and impact the game higher up the pitch.
OK, great. So, Fergal Brennan, thank you for your contribution. Alan Colley, enjoy Talca Park this evening. I see, actually, 515-5260, Ireland-Portugal match sold out with 4 weeks to go. Positivity is back in Irish football, Alan Colley. Can we end before the ad break on a positive note?
Shane, we met at 10 o'clock on Tuesday night. What was my face like? Yeah. I haven't gotten over it yet either, Shane.
We might hear about that on Monday. That still might be a low light, even just from the hangover
It was a yearly low light.
Alan Colley, enjoy Talca Park. Thank you for joining us. We're taking a short ad break. We're chatting golf with Brian Keogh next.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Now, time to chat golf. Shane Lowry is one shot off the lead after the second round of the DP World India Championship. Lowry, who was the overnight leader after a stunning opening round of 64, was unable to match the highlight of his first day, but still signed for a second round of 369, which moved him to 11 under. The Ryder Cup hero sits one shot behind clubhouse leader Tommy Fleetwood, who was out on his own on 12 under after shooting a bogey-free round of 64 that included 8 birdies. Brian Harman shares second place with Lowry after signing for a 65. Golf writer Brian Keogh joins us on the line now. Brian, how impressive has Shane been, and also how much of that confidence is down to the Ryder Cup?
Yeah, I think he would probably have been feeling a little bit tired after the Ryder Cup, after all the celebrations, and you know, you could see it in his first event back in Madrid, you know, where he missed the cut first round 75. But definitely, you know, the putting, you know, the confidence he would have got from just holding that 6 foot putt in the Ryder Cup has certainly stood to him, because he held 7-8 really, you know, serious putts between 8, 12, 15 feet in that first round. And that's probably the little bit that's been missing from Shane really over the last few years, is, you know, converting those putts and turning that consistency that he has into wins. So, you know, it's been 3 years since he won an individual event. So hopefully this will be the week for him.
Yeah, how transformational do you feel the Ryder Cup can be, particularly if he goes on to win this tournament, just even mentally, to kind of give him that springboard?
Yeah, I think it'll be a big help to him. You know, I mean, Shane has been a top player now for the past, what, 10 years. And, you know, he's established himself as a top player on the PGA Tour over the last while, a major winner. And he was just so consistent, really, over the last, you know, 18 months, 2 years. And it's just converting those, that consistency into victories is what he's trying to do. But he's competing, of course, in all the biggest and best events in the game. So he's up against your Scotty Scheffler's and Rory McIlroy's every time he tees it up. So, you know, Shane is playing at an incredibly high level, and it just shows you how difficult it is to win at the highest level, as we can see from, you know, Tommy Fleetwood struggles to get a win in America as well. So I think there's a lot more to come from Shane Lowry over the next few years, definitely.
Can he put it up to those guys on a consistent basis?
Well, I think, you know, Scotty Scheffler, when he's on, I mean, I think Shane would even admit that when Scotty Scheffler is on his game or Rory McIlroy is on his game, you know, they're almost impossible to beat. But when Shane Lowry is playing his best stuff, he has the game, as he's shown in majors, you know, contending, that he has the game to get over the line, you know. So it's just a lot of it. The time, it depends on just how confident he's feeling with that short stick, and he's put a huge amount of work into that over the last few years to get some freedom there and just convert that, you know, that wonderful, you know, driving accuracy and ball striking, especially with the long irons, as we've seen in Indy this week, into you know, more chances.
Staying with the DP World India Championship, so Rory McIlroy shot a successive 69 and a 6 under par, tied 17th. He left his driver behind in the opening round, but what have you made of Rory so far?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a really, really old-fashioned, tight golf course. I mean, really, really narrow. Bushes everywhere, trees everywhere. So, you know, there's no real advantage for him hitting driver. You know, you have to hit it about 270 yards off the tee, which you can do, you know, with an iron or 5 wood, I think, is the longest club he has in the bag. So, you know, he's been making a few unforced errors and short-sighting himself here and there, but he's still there. I mean, a low one tomorrow morning, and he admitted himself today that he's going to have to get after it very early tomorrow and make birdies. You know, 64 or 63 would put Rory back in the mix. So it's not a course that you'd say sets up really for Rory McIlroy's game. Obviously, taking the driver out of his hands is taken away one of his major weapons, isn't it? So, you know, it's still a chance for him to move further ahead in the race to Dubai before we get to the playoffs in Abu Dhabi and then the race to Dubai finale.
Yeah, just put this into context for us, Brian. Like, how prestigious is this tournament or not?
Well, it's the first one that they've had. It's, you know, it's obviously DP World are a major sponsor for the European Tour. They've renamed the tour the DP World Tour because of the cash injection they make. So it's another market, isn't it, that they're opening up. I mean, the LIV Golf are obviously in India. Bryson DeChambeau was there earlier this year. So, you know, it's a prestigious old golf course. They've got a very good feel there. You know, they've got quite a few of the top players in the world there. McIlroy, obviously, Fleetwood. And then, you know, Ben Griffin, Hovland, Lowry, Brian Harman, you know, major winners. So, you know, it'll be a feather in the cap of anybody who wins this week, I think.
Is it a lucrative market? Is this somewhere that the golf wants to break into?
Well, I think, you know, it's the most populous country in the world, isn't it? And, you know, they've got, obviously, the number one sport over there is cricket. I think it'll be hard to knock that off its pedestal. But certainly these are, you know, markets that the DP World Tour would be keen to exploit and, you know, extend their footprint around the world, as they did in the, you know, in the 90s and the 2000s with such a big presence in Asia and Africa and Australia. So, you know, we see Rory, you know, obviously heading back down to Australia as well later this year. So perhaps a sign of, you know, his intent over the next few years to play this more of a worldwide schedule and perhaps less on the PGA Tour.
There was another Irishman on course today. So Conor Purcell missed the cut despite carding an impressive second round, 3 under par 69. He ended 1 under overall, missing out in the cut by just one shot. What have you made of Conor's game at the moment?
Yeah, Conor, you know, I mean, he won on the Challenge Tour. He got his card last year. He's been in and out. You know, he's pretty much missed half the cuts, you know, in the events that he's played. Probably, you know, you'd say himself, his iron play hasn't been, you know, up to scratch. The courses are more difficult. He's getting to know them for the first time now, having played on the Challenge Tour before. So that's all new. It's only 115 guys keep their cards. So really, you know, driving accuracy, you know, can be a problem for Conor at times. So that's something he'll be looking to work on. So whether, you know, he goes to Q School to try and improve his status or goes back and plays a bit more on the Challenge Tour, we'll see. But he's learning his trade, put it that way, I think. Conor, plenty of talent there. And I think we haven't heard the last of him.
You've also been following the progress of a couple of other Irish golfers on the tour, Brian.
On the European Tour?
Yeah. Like like the likes of Tom McKibben, even James Sugar coming through. There's kind of talent coming through the ranks here that perhaps aren't. Now, I know Tom McKibben is pretty much at this stage a household name, but others that perhaps mightn't be on the radars of individuals.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there has been a little bit of, you know, the weeping and gnashing of teeth, you know, about the number of Irish players on tour. I had a quick look, you know, at how many we had on tour over the years. You know, if you go back to the 70s, you know, the average number of guys in the top 100 on the tour, it's about 8 in the 70s, about 8 in the 80s, about 7 in the 90s, you know, so it's been around that. The tour has become so much more global. You know, in the last 15 years, we have really, you know, 4 or 5 players really, you know, playing on the DP World regularly. So we need to get more guys off that Challenge Tour onto the DP World Tour. So at the moment we've got, you know, Liam Nolan from Galway and Max Kennedy from Dublin, both on the Challenge Tour, both in the top 45 in the standings. At the penultimate event, they have to finish in the top 20 in the rankings at the Challenge Tour Grand Final in a couple of weeks' time to win European Tour cards. So they've got work to do. Max is actually 45th and, you know, touch and go whether he actually makes it to the Grand Final. But, you know, there's guys like that coming through. And then you have, you know, 8 guys getting through the first stage of the qualifying school as well, plus a couple more from the Challenge Tour will be at the latter stages. So there's players like Mark Power, Alex Maguire, we saw in the Irish Open play very well there. You know, then on the, you know, the third tier tours, you've got like James Sugar coming back to a bit of form now after, you know, going through COVID and various injuries, Ronan Mullarney, you know, Hugh Foley, people like that. So, you know, there are players coming through. And of course, we had a couple of guys on the Walker Cup team as well there back in September. So be interested to see how they progress, plus the, you know, 10 or 15 guys we have playing top college golf in America as well. So, you know, I think it's a bit too soon to say what, you know, what the post McIlroy Lowry era will look like. You know, we've got Tom McKibben there, and I think there's always a chance of players coming through. We can never write off Irish golf. I don't think we've always had 2, 3, 4 top players over the past 30, 40 years.
Long may it continue. Brian Keogh, thank you so much for your contribution. We're taking a short ad break, then returning our attention to hurling in the company of Mark Landers.
Game on.
Hurling.
Now, Middleton and Sarsfields contest this year's Cork Premier Senior Hurling Championship final on Sunday. The action gets underway at 3:15 at Supervalue Parky Cueve. Mark Landers is with us to preview this one. But before we chat about the action, Mark, this is known in certain circles as the Little All-Ireland. So what makes the Cork Championship so special, Mark?
I suppose, Shane, you have to go back through history, really. I suppose the first team to ever win the Cork Senior Hurling Championship were Tower Street. They won it in 1888. They beat Ballygavin in that game. And I suppose the other interesting things about the Little All-Ireland is that in 1901, 1902 and 1903, the matches were played in Turner's Cross, as we all know, as a soccer field. At that time, that field used to be known as Johnny Butler's Field, and a Gaelic football club by the team called the Nils, were now defunct, actually had a lease on the field, and they used to make the field available to the county board. From then on, I suppose all the matches were played in the Athletic Ground, which became known as the Old Athletic Grounds after Parky Cueve was built. And I suppose in the building of Parky Cueve during 74 and 75, the county finals were played in the Mardyke, another famous venue, UCC, obviously. And I suppose in 76, the first county final was played in the new Parky Cueve, shall we say, even though it got a revamp afterwards. And the Glen Rovers beat Black Rock in that final. And a year later, Shane, in 1977, the largest ever attendance at a county final, 35,000 people, when the Bears again defeated Glen Rovers. So there's a huge amount of history associated with the Cork Senior Hurling Final.
The big three, really, the Glen, the Bowers and the Rockies. Like, the Rockies have 32 counties, the Glen has 27, the Bowers have 26 between them. Huge players down through the years. Christy Ring, Drake Lynch, John Fenton, Frank Cummins from Kilkenny, Teddy McCarthy, dual All-Ireland winner in 1990, played with Sars in the county final in 97 against the McKilly. And then you have the Fitzgibbons from the Glen, the Cashman from the Rockies, John Allen, John Moyle, JBM from the Bowers. People that roll off your tongue, to be honest, that have played in county senior hurling finals. And I'm sure Sunday will be no different, Shane. But that's kind of a little bit of a trip down memory lane of what makes it what we call the Little All-Ireland.
No, it's absolutely magic. And I must say, I must plead my ignorance here. I've been to Turner's Cross on so many occasions watching soccer matches, and I never knew the Gaelic Games background. I think Porky Rinn has a bit of a soccer background as well, but I'm very much open to correction of that. Well, I'm glad you corrected me. I'm glad you agreed with me on that one. Listen, we are down to the last two, battling it out for the Sean Og Murphy Cup. Both sides enter unbeaten, a clash of tradition, form, fierce ambition. Who was impressed more in their journey to the final?
Good question, Shane, to be honest with you. I suppose you look at Middleton at the moment in the quarterfinal and the semi-final, they were led by Glen Rovers by 7 points. And in the semi-final against the Rockies, they were 6 points down. On both occasions with 20 minutes to go, it didn't look good for them. But they fought their way back and they won two matches very, very narrowly. I suppose they'd be seen as a really stubborn team at this moment in time. Now, they have showed plenty of backbone to actually get to the final by winning those matches in tight circumstances and coming from behind. Now, obviously, they have been dealt a severe blow insofar that Owen Maloney and it seems Conor Lehane are bought out. Owen plays fullback. He's after tearing his Achilles heel, and it has become public knowledge now, I suppose, that Conor Lehane has also torn his Achilles heel. And Midland has said, I suppose, that he's out, but you know yourself now, it's a bit like if you believe.
There are rumours that he might play some part.
Liam Cahill said before the All-Ireland final he wasn't going to play a sweeper, but they ended up with a plus seven. So I suppose we won't really know that until we come to the throw-in whether Conor Lehane will take his place. But I mean, certainly when Midland won in 2021, Conor scored 3-10. He was imperious at centre forward, and he's been a brilliant, brilliant player for Midland. But he'd be a massive loss for Middleton. Sales had a very impressive start to the season. They lost one of their star players in Colin McCarthy. He got injured, tore his cruciate in the quarter final. But they were impressive in the semi final against St Finbarr's. They won by a point, but at no stage did you actually think that the Bears were going to win. Sales, to be fair to them, not having won the county final last year, they were beaten by Imakili, who were a divisional team, so they couldn't take their place in the Munster Club Championship. Sales went on to win that in a famous victory against Ballygunner in Turles, which was, I suppose, one of their crowning glories. They didn't perform that great in the All-Ireland final against Nafina. And I think, Shane, deep down, there's two things driving Sales this year. They obviously didn't win the county last year, and they want to set that right for the record. And I think they feel they didn't do themselves justice in the All-Ireland final in Croke Park, and they're itching to get back there.
Do you think that will linger as added motivation? It isn't a case of just histories in the past.
I think it will. Like, Sars are a really good club. I suppose people will remember back to the Storms that time when they left the water into their field and destroyed their field for 12 months just so that the water could subside. They'd be seen as a really positive club as well in terms of their attitude. So, and they supplied a huge amount of players down through the years to the inter-county team, you know, the likes of Teddy Mack, Bertie Og Murphy, Tyg Og Murphy, Pat Ryan, and I suppose currently Jack O'Connor is involved at the moment. So I think part of their DNA is to try and achieve as much as they can. And they're usually successful at underage as well. They're competing in semi-finals and finals at under 14, 16, minor and under 20 every year. So they really get about their business very good.
I know it could be a fatal blow, Eve Lahan, and well, we know Maloney's going to be out, but call it for me now. Like, can Middleton even stop such a potent forward line that Sars have, Jack O'Connor, Barry O'Flynn, Keane Darcy, or how do you see it playing out when it's all said and done, Mark?
Yeah, I suppose there's a couple of things at play here. Like, you obviously have a new Cork senior manager in Brian Sanderson, who's in goals for Middleton. This is a huge final for him, I think, in terms of making a statement to Ben O'Connor. I also think Tommy O'Connell at centre-back has been outstanding. He's been very unlucky not to make the senior team in Cork, and I think Middleton will probably focus on Tommy. Sean O'Mara, Mikey Finn as well. Mikey Finn is a very, very talented player. And then up front, obviously, Cormac Buzang was involved in the past with Cork. He's having a rich frame of form, as is Per White. And here's an interesting one. Killian McDermott, who transferred from Clare in Clare Castle, his former club are in the intermediate final in Clare on Sunday, and Killian is playing in the senior hurling final in Cork on Sunday. So I think those players will carry an awful lot of weight in terms of Middleton giving of their best. But I'd have to give the nod to Sars. I think they're a really established team. You know, Craig Leahy, Brian Murphy, who transfers from Kerry, played into county with Kerry, his captaining Sars this year, and Luke Elliott, a really physical, strong half-back line. And young lads in like Daniel Hogan, Keane Darcy and Cahill McCarthy have been outstanding for them this year. As you mentioned, Barry Flynn, obviously a young lad has come through the underage ranks. But I think the likes of Keane Darcy, Cahill McCarthy and Daniel Hogan, those three players in particular, I think they want to make a statement as well for their own future. They have definitely inter-county prospects ahead of them.
Okay, great stuff. Mark Landis, you're a gentleman. Thank you so much for outlining all of that. There will be updates of that final and all of the weekend's county final action on Radio 1's Sunday Sport.
Game on. Racing.
Now, there is domestic racing at Limerick and Leopardstown this weekend, and we'll be chatting about that very shortly. But Jane Mangan joins us on the line to look a little further afield and preview Champions Day at Ascot. A record 5 Group 1 races featuring some of the best horses in the world will be on show tomorrow. So Jane, let's go chronologically. We kick off at 5-1 with the newest Group 1 Long Distance Cup run at the top level for the first time. Aidan O'Brien has a couple of entries, but will anyone get close to William Buick on board Trawlerman?
Well, it looks like this is a pivotal day for the Gosden team as they try to reel in Aidan O'Brien in the Trainers' Championship. I suppose the irony of this day is it brings the curtain down on the flat season on the turf in the UK, but the Trainers' Championship incidentally runs to the end of the calendar year. Trawlerman is favoured for John and Thady Gosden. It's his race to lose. We haven't seen him since he won emphatically at York, and of course he did win the Ascot Gold Cup earlier this year. In the omission and the absence of Kyprios, he is the new king of the stairs. Aidan O'Brien's got Stay True in there and Saratoga as well, but all form being equal, Trawlerman is the one to beat. This is the richest day on the British racing calendar. This is a new Group 1. Its title is Group 1. Its actual nature this year alone, probably Group 3.
Oh, okay. Not ideal for first run at Group 1, considering who's involved. And there was a maximum 20 runner field for the Champions Sprint declared, but Rosie Affair is now a non-runner, but still a big field. The race goes to post at 2:05. Who catches your eye here?
Well, I think this is actually a proper sprint in a season where we haven't really had a standout sprinter. I think Francis Graffard's Rayevka, who was second in the Prix de l'Abbé in Paris 2 weeks ago, he stands out to me as a current 20-1 shot. Paddy Toomey's going to send across King Kuhn. There's a couple of big outsiders with chances in here, but such is the nature of the division this year, you would have a chance. Lazat is currently favoured for Jérôme Renier. So the French hold a very strong hand. If I was to have a fancy, I think it would be Rayevka, but I wouldn't be getting behind any of these sprinters with any great deal of confidence.
Okay, now defending champion Kalpana will look to get her first victory of the year in the Fillies and Mares Stakes at 2:45. How confident are you she runs to her best here, because she'll need to in such an open contest?
She will, yeah. She hasn't produced a performance like last year's performance all season. She hasn't managed to win. She disappointed when she was beaten 7 lengths in the arc, and I don't think she deserves to be as short a favourite as she is. I think David O'Mara is as strange as the one that I like. She was second to Minnie Hawk at York. She has very good form before that, and she sidestepped the arc, so she's coming here a fresh filly. Christiana and Francis Graffard's other filly, Latakia, they come here from France. Latakia is a big price after disappointing in the pre-Royal last time, but I don't think she stayed. Paddy Toomey's going to run One Look. Aidan O'Brien has got A Bedtime Story. Joseph runs We Might Take the Long Way. So the Irish have every chance of taking a good share of Sterling home, but I would be thinking a strange might take the whole cigar.
Okay, now the QE2, so the Queen Elizabeth II Stakes 25 past 3 features 8 Group 1 winners with a total of 16 top level victories between them. Field of Gold makes his long awaited return, having looked a superstar when rattling off successes in the Irish 2000 Guineas and the St James's Palace Stakes. So do you think he will return to that level of form tomorrow here, or who are you watching?
I think he's the best miler in training, and I thought that when he won the St James's Palace. I thought that when he put up an unbelievable display at the Curragh back in May. Obviously, everybody was disappointed with what he produced at Goodwood, but I think everybody knows he's better than that. And it's a big day for Colin Keane, obviously, with this guy and Kalpana. Field of Gold is the one they all have to beat. Rosalian, he's been a bit of a bridesmaid this year. He's next in the betting. Fallen Angel has been a fabulous mare after reading off a hat-trick of wins at the highest level this season. She's currently around 13-2. Never So Brave, Docklands. The Lion in Winter is in there for Aidan O'Brien, the Mount of Christoph Soumillon. Johnny Murta runs Alakazi for the Aga Khan. Ben Cohen, big ride for him. But Field of Gold, I think if he wins this, he gets the crown of champion miler for the season.
Now, the big money race, 4:05, the Champion Stakes, 3 of the best horses in the world. So, Jane Mangan, out of the big tree, do you prefer Ombudsman, Delacroix or Calandigan?
Yeah, it's such a difficult question to answer. I probably would be with Ombudsman, and he's currently favoured. I think he's the right favourite. He obviously won the Prince of Wales. He won the Judmont International. He's a very high class horse. He famously didn't come to Leopardstown, which was most frustrating. So he didn't meet Delacroix there. Delacroix reopposes here, which is fabulous to see him run once more before he goes to Coolmore and Tipperary for stud duties next year. Calandigan, the gelding from France, he was awesome in Ascot last time when he beat Kalpana and the King George. He comes here a fresh horse. Economics, first run of the year, huge ask for him. Haven't seen him since this day last year. Almeric Al-Makam, Fox Legacy, first look is my each way nibble of the race. Andre Fabre's horse, who was brilliant on Arc Weekend in Paris. But this is, as the title suggests it is, a champion's race, £800,000. This is exactly the kind of race it should be. 2 weeks ago, we had the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe. This is a smaller field, but one could argue it's more concentrated quality.
Well, it should be an absolute cracking contest. So that's Champions Day at Ascot. Let us end our conversation a bit closer to home. I mentioned there's domestic racing at Limerick and indeed in Leopardstown. The Munster National, 4:15 on Sunday in Limerick.
Yeah, fabulous race always. 16 runners go to post for this 3-mile contest, a real stamina test. And I think the rain is forecast to come this weekend as well, so it'll be proper Limerick weather. JP McManus is trebly represented with In Excelsis Joe, Nara and Pride of Place, but I think it's actually Gavin Cromwell's Yaman is of most interest to me. He's currently second top of the weight with Keith Dunhue riding at 11-8. Gordon Elliott's got Yates Star, Boston Rover, Willie Mullins is nav handed with You Oughta Know and Arctic Fly, but I think Yaman will appreciate the stamina and any rain that falls in what is one of the, I suppose, kickstarts of the proper national hunt season.
Great stuff. Jane Mangan, thank you for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Game on. Racing.
Now, we are going out the same way we came in, and that is chatting League of Ireland. Damien O'Mara joins us from Inchicore, ahead of St Patrick's Athletic against Shamrock Rovers. Shamrock Rovers with the chance to be crowned League of Ireland champions. Damien can set the scene. And teams have just landed, Damien?
They have indeed, yeah. It's going to be a third time lucky, Rovers fans. Hope denied us with defeat to Shells last weekend. Derry's late win over Sligo the previous week means the celebrations in Tala have been put on ice on 3 occasions. It's very simple tonight. A point for Rovers will secure the title. They can even afford to lose if Derry are beaten by Waterford this evening. Massive game as well for St Pat's, crucial in their run in. 6 in the table, 6 points off Shelburne in third place, and that defeat in the Cup to Cork, a big blow to them in terms of European football next season. 3 changes for Pats from that Cork defeat. Jordan Garrick, Ryan McLaughlin and Jason McClellan drop out. Barry Crowe Bagley, Carl Solberg and Al Amin Kazim are into the side. 2 changes for Rovers from their game against Shells, their defeat last time out. Sean Kavanagh comes comes into defence in place of Trevor Clark. Rory Gaffney drops to the bench. He's replaced up top by Michael Noonan. No Pico Lopez in the squad tonight, obviously part of Cape Verde's World Cup qualification squad earlier in the week. We are led to believe, or certainly our understanding is, he has more important things to be worrying about today. He may be at home man-marking a newly born son, Diego, who landed into the world late this afternoon. So that puts everything into context, that there are things, league titles aside perhaps, that are more important than football, Shane.
Most certainly. We send our congratulations to all of the Lopez family. Can St. Pat's handle the pressure? Will they be able to spoil the party this evening?
I think that's the big question, isn't it? And it's funny talking to people about the fact that Rovers won the league title on this ground 2 years ago. Still stings for a couple of people, but listen, we talk, one of those cliches, we talk about cup final football. If Pats want to be in Europe this season, there's four games left for each side. They're on the coattails of the sides ahead of them in the table, but to control it and be in their own destiny, they need a performance maybe unlike one we've seen from them so far this season tonight.
Okay, great stuff. Damon O'Mara, thank you so much for checking in with us from Inchicore. That is all we have time for this evening. Thank you for listening. Game On returns Monday at 6 o'clock, where we will review all the best bits from the weekend. Today's show was produced by Barry O'Neill and our broadcast coordinator was Jarla Holland. Up next here on 2FM, the official chart show. So do not go anywhere. From all of the Game On team, have a great weekend. Mind yourself. It's bye for now.